Thank you. This is the sixth time that I've spoken in Sweden, which practically makes me a migrant here. I first came here in April of 2015. It was right after my first visit to England. And when I went to England, I felt not like I was going abroad, but like I was coming home. It was very familiar because my ancestry's English going back hundreds of years. My family has been in the colonies for 400 years, or about exactly 400 years when I arrived in England. And then I came to Sweden, and it was odd. I had a very similar experience. It was very much like coming home. I grew up in the Northwest in the United States, heavily peopled by Scandinavian immigrants. The names were familiar. The place names were familiar. The look of the people was familiar. I felt very much like I was coming home. I appreciated the fact that you drove on the correct side of the road. The language was intimidating, but if you know German and you know English, you can sort of puzzle your way through a lot of Swedish signs and announcements. And so I rapidly felt very comfortable here, and I like coming back. And one of the main reasons why I got invited to Sweden in the first place was that I have a lot of readers here. The top country every month in terms of readership is the United States, for obvious reasons. It's based there, I'm American, etc. Then generally what you would have is the UK would be number two, Canada would be number three, Australia would be number four, then you get France and Germany, and down around number seven was always Sweden. And Sweden is a country of 9 million white people. It's an honorary Anglosphere country because you all speak English so well and read English so well. And so it didn't really surprise me that we had a lot of readers here. And I started developing friends and contacts here, and that's what's led me to be here and to be back here. Also, Sweden has distinguished itself by being the country where my books have been translated most often and first. So the Nationalist Manifesto is the third translation of one of my books. The first translation into any language was the Swedish edition of New Right versus Old Right. Truth, Justice, and a Nice White Country came out. Again, that's the first and only translation of that book into a foreign language. And this is the first translation of my manifesto. The manifesto came out almost exactly 1 year ago. I've just put out a new edition of it in English. We now have the Swedish translation. There is a Ukrainian translation that is about to be launched. There is a fellow working on a Portuguese translation. Spanish and Polish translations are getting started soon, if not already underway. And I'm looking to get translations done into German, French, and Italian. But the Swedes were first. You guys are at the vanguard here, and I very much appreciate that. So give yourselves a hand. I want to thank everyone who's organized this event, the publisher, the translator, the editors, the people who did the audio version of this book, and all of you for coming out and hearing me. I very much appreciate it. When I prepared the second edition of this book back in August, I read through it again for the first time in a year. And once it was done, I just didn't want to look at it for a while. And so I read through it again. I found two typos that sort of stabbed me in the heart. You know, how did these things get through? There was a mistake in the index, but pretty much I was satisfied with it. I don't think this is the best case that could ever be made for ethno-nationalism, white ethno-nationalism. I'd like somebody else to come along and outdo it, but I feel like it's the best case that I could do for this particular argument, the best case that I could make. And I'm going to keep this book in print. I'm going to keep bringing out new editions if I figure out ways of improving it. And I'm going to pursue new translations. And the next thing I'm going to do is try and take into account all the changes that have happened in the world in the last year. Because in the year since this book was first published, there have been some dramatic changes, not just in the political world, but in the intellectual world. And I really want to talk about those intellectual changes and how it would change the way I would write this book if I were to write it again today. And I'm actually working on another book now that's called White Identity Politics. And the White Identity Politics book takes into account some very useful books that have been published in the last year. I want to talk about a couple of these books and just give you a roadmap of that project. I want to share this with you because I think it's profoundly encouraging what's happening. This is a white pill speech. There's a lot of, I think, room for optimism in our cause. If I were to define white nationalism over again today, I would put it somewhat differently. We're here because we are far-sighted people, because we're looking down the road and seeing ominous trends that have to be changed. We don't like the future that's being prepared for us. We want to interrupt the future that's being prepared for us. Most people, however, are not far-sighted. Most people don't think many years ahead. And that's why democracy is often a very bad political system. Because what democracy does is it allows ambitious people to gain power by appealing to the masses, and the masses are always short-sighted. So people can gain power by proposing ideas that sound good in the short run but have disastrous long-term consequences, knowing that relatively few people can think ahead to the disastrous consequences. The far-sighted few are outvoted by the short-sighted many. And that's the problem we face. So one of the problems for us is to how to explain our politics to short-sighted people. People who only think a year or two ahead. And so I want to formulate white nationalism as follows. First of all, white nationalism just means the independence, the ethnic self-determination of all European peoples in whatever homelands they have. So white nationalism means Swedish nationalism in Sweden and Norwegian nationalism in Norway. That's all it means, okay, as far as I'm concerned. So what does white nationalism mean in Sweden? White nationalism is the radical proposal, the shocking radical proposal that next year, the percentage of the Swedish population that's ethnically Swedish will be greater than it is this year. Whereas the entire current establishment in Sweden, all the political parties, are committed to the position that next year there will be fewer Swedes in Sweden. Now, if you were to propose this idea, this radical idea, that we want political policies in place that will make sure that next year there are more Swedes in Sweden, and the year after that, still more, is there any really good argument against that proposal? It's not the kind of proposal that an honest person can raise their hand and say, well, why do you believe that? What's your justification for that? The proper answer, the natural answer to a proposal like that is not why, but why not? Why wouldn't we want more Swedes in Sweden next year than there are this year? Why wouldn't we want the Swedish percentage of Sweden's population to be higher next year than it is this year? I think if you put it in those short terms, it's what we call an easy sell. People are always saying, Greg, you've got to tone it down a bit. This is very radical. It's very hard to sell people on the idea of a homeland named Sweden for the Swedes. That's very controversial and problematic these days. You got to tone it down. But I honestly think that if you propose it to people in those simple terms, it's got to be the easiest sell possible. The only answer that people can have if they want to say, no, that's not a good idea, is practically an admission that they don't like Swedes. They hate Swedish people. They want there to be fewer Swedes in Sweden next year. That would be a good thing. And next year after that, and next year after that. And of course, they want to blur the long term out because the long term trend means that eventually there'll be no Swedish people in Sweden. And what sense does that make? So, the project that I want to work on now is trying to connect some of the ideas which are kind of radical and fundamental and long-term, thinking about white extinction and white genocide and how to create white homelands to stop it. These are all things that happen in the far future. How do we relate to people as they are right now, today, especially short-sighted people who are alive today and only think a couple years down the road? Well, it turns out there's quite a bit of evidence now that our people are increasingly concerned about ethnic identity issues and ethnic displacement. We've been predicting this for a very long time, that as non-white immigration and race replacement grows, that more and more people will be concerned about this. They'll become more aware of it, and they'll want to stop it. So the first book I want to recommend to you is a book by two British academics. It's called National Populism, The Revolt Against Liberal Democracy by Roger Eatwell and Matthew Goodwin. This came out last November, and I picked it up and added it to a stack of recent books on populism, thinking that this would be another globalist establishment attack on national populism. And I was very pleased at how wrong I was about this book. Even though these authors are men of the left, it's very clear they're not liberal. They're anti-liberal men of the left, and they have a sympathy on some level for populism. They see that liberal democracy, as it's practiced today, basically means minority rule. Minority rule and an establishment that makes an art and really just enjoys sticking it to the public and figuring out ways of never giving the public what they want. And Eatwell and Goodwin are really enjoying and getting a lot of mileage out of what's happened since the Brexit vote, because that's exactly what's happening in the UK. The British establishment is doing everything it possibly can to not give the people what they want. And that's really the way that post-war liberal democracy is structured in every white country around the world. It's a very clever system that doesn't give the people what they want. And people are becoming increasingly aware of this, and this is what's causing the rise of national populist parties and candidates and initiatives all across the white world. Trump, Brexit. These were huge shocks to the progressive liberal establishment because they really believe that there's this thing called progress, that the arc of history bends in the direction of what they want. And when Trump and Brexit came along, it shook them up. If Brexit can happen, Trump could get elected. And if Trump could get elected, Marine Le Pen could get elected. And then it's all over, right? I was really hoping Marine Le Pen would get elected. It was profoundly shocking to the left, and that's why they've basically been having a collective nervous breakdown ever since Brexit and Trump, because this wasn't supposed to happen. And so they came up with all these coping ideas, these coping mechanisms, these little stories they told themselves that really, really soon progress is going to be back. So one of the things they said is that, well, this is the last hurrah of old, angry white people who are going to die off and be replaced by vibrant non-whites who will vote like we liberal Democrats want them to vote. When they say that, that's a vision of utopia. When we talk about that, that's a conspiracy theory called the Great Replacement. But that's one of the things that they said. It's just the last hurrah of old white men. They're going to die off, they'll be replaced, and then we're going to have a vibrant multicultural utopia. We're going to fill Europe up with Muslims. And then we're finally going to have gay marriage everywhere. Everyone's going to be a vegetarian and wear sandals, and women will be respected. Once we get a Muslim majority and they're all going to vote like white liberals want them to, then we're going to finally triumph over the forces of reaction and have our liberal utopia. That's the plan. And it's a highly delusional and questionable plan, but that's their plan. And in America, the version is that they're going to fill the country up with Mexicans, and then we're going to have a sort of Scandinavian-style liberal utopia with a majority Mexican population dutifully voting the way that the tiny remaining population of white liberals wants them to vote. That's the plan. Eatwell and Goodwin basically argue that that's not happening. that things aren't going to get back on track anytime soon, that all the liberal coping that they've been doing is based on false premises. And they argue that the trend towards national populism is not just a momentary flash in the pan, but that it is the product of some long-term, deep-seated trends in all white societies. And they talk about four trends, and they call them the four Ds. They give them names that begin with D. So the first trend is distrust. The amount of distrust of the people for the establishment in every white society has been growing tremendously. And of course, populism basically is premised on the people distrusting the elites, feeling like the elites are disconnected and pursuing their own interests at the expense of the people. If you believe that, you're a populist. And the number of people who are believing that thesis grows every year and has been growing every year for decades now. This is a long-term, deep-seated trend. It just didn't happen overnight with Trump or Brexit. It's been happening a long time, and there's no sign that it's going to change because people are more and more aware of the fact that the establishment really doesn't represent their interests, that it's out of touch, that it's contemptuous of the electorate, and that it wants a future where we have no future. That's not going to change anytime soon. People are not going to suddenly get dumber overnight and go back to trusting the government or trusting the establishment, unless, of course, they actually change the direction of their policies, but they are bound and determined not to change their policies. They want to double down on their policies. The other trend they talk about is the destruction of societies by immigration and multiculturalism. And it's very interesting. Eatwell and Goodwin say that diversity is destructive, and many, many white people are experiencing that. They recognize that there are more and more areas of their country that don't resemble the country they grew up in. And very large numbers of people are coming to the conclusion that that's wrong. A lot of people want to die in a country that somewhat resembles the country they grew up in. And that's another way that you can put our politics, right? We can say white nationalism or Swedish nationalism is the radical, terrifying idea, this terrifying dystopian vision of the future, that the country you die in will be like the country you grew up in. That when you die, you're not going to be surrounded by strangers, thieving, abusive people from other cultures who just want you to die and get out of their way. That's one way that we can present our vision of the future. And interestingly enough, the authors of this book defend the idea that there's nothing wrong about that. It doesn't make you a bad person to want to preserve the character of your society, including the ethnic character of your society, for future generations, or just for yourself for the rest of your days. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's very interesting. The left, whenever they hear people talking like this, what's the first thing they always accuse them of? Racism. They go straight for the racism charge. And large numbers of people are very indignant when that happens. They don't think there's anything bad or racist about wanting to preserve your country from dramatic ethnic and cultural change. That is a consensus that's growing. And the racism word isn't inhibiting people. Now, these people still believe that racism is a really bad thing, and they don't want to be a racist, but they don't think they are racist. And so they're very, very angry when people call them this bad word and say they're these bad people with bad thoughts, that they're racists. The third trend they call deprivation, and that just means the destruction of working class and middle class living standards in white countries by globalization, sending factories and jobs overseas, importing cheap labor here. That trend has been going on for decades now. The destruction of working class and middle class incomes in first world societies is a trend going back to the 1970s. Many of you never lived in a society where the average Joe, the average working person, could expect a better future than their parents. And a lot of people are getting really angry about that. A lot of people see the negative effects of globalization. And then the final trend they talk about is de-alignment. And de-alignment simply means that people are no longer going to vote for the center-left or the center-right option. Post-war politics in the white world is basically the following system. You've got a center-left party and a center-right party that trade power occasionally with one another, and they will compete on issues like abortion or taxes or feminism, things like that. But there are certain things that they agree not to compete on. They have agreed not to compete on multiculturalism, immigration, and economic globalization. No matter what party you choose for, they're going to give you more multiculturalism, more globalization, more immigration. The most revolutionary thing that Donald Trump did in 2015, when he glided down the golden escalator at Trump Tower and announced that he was running for president, is that he broke that cartel, that gentleman's agreement, not to compete on immigration and globalization. He didn't have to do that. He could have still won the presidency by following the rules and not competing on those important issues. He chose to compete on those issues, and therefore he had to fight a two-front war against the Democratic Party and his own party to get the presidency. That was revolutionary because it showed that there were large numbers of people, 60-plus million people in the United States, who really would vote for a nationalist candidate, a candidate who had an America-first foreign policy, was anti-globalization, and was anti-immigration. That was terrifying to the establishment. He broke the gentleman's agreement. He broke the political cartel that's been in place since the Second World War, basically. And now we see this de-alignment happening all over Europe. In the last French presidential election, we had the far-right candidate, the national populist candidate, against a guy and a party that were basically new to everybody, Macron. Macron was being presented or was a sort of a synthetic political outsider, quote-unquote outsider, who was actually an insider. He was a minister in the socialist government who broke with them and ran as a maverick and basically got elected. Why did they do that? Why did they engage in that charade of having a socialist run as an independent? Well, because the Socialist Party was cooked, basically. They had so little credibility after Hollande that they weren't going to run this next socialist candidate as a socialist candidate, so they had this Macron character, this fake populist maverick. That's the only way they could win, is by running an establishment candidate as an anti-establishment candidate. The last French presidential election is as revolutionary and shocking as an American presidential election where there's no Democrat and no Republican in the final running, basically. That would be a truly shocking thing. People are leaving this center-left, center-right charade behind. They realize it is a charade. They realize it's a way of controlling the populace. They realize it's a way of distracting us, and it's a way of not giving the people what they want. And democracy should be about giving the people what they want.
Liberal democracy is basically not giving the people what they want. And when you actually get rumblings of real democracy, people call that populism.
And they write ridiculous books like Yasha Monk's book, The People Versus Democracy, on the terrible threat of populism. We've reviewed the Monk book at Countercurrents. But national populism is not in that vein. And they end by claiming that not only is national populism deep-seated based on trends going back decades, generations even, but it's going to be around us for a long time to come. And in fact, the only way that the political establishment can survive is by basically adopting national populist policies or national populist light policies, and which really means that globalization as the dominant political model is over, and that nationalism and populism are the future. That's a very, very encouraging message. And it's a surprising message for a couple of left-of-center British political scientists to be putting out there. But I find it very, very convincing. So I want to build on that, and we need to figure out how to build on that. Now, the other book that I want to just point out to you briefly is a work by this woman named Ashley Jardina. She's a political science professor at Duke University. She called her book White Identity Politics. I was intending to write a book with the same title, and guess what? I still am. You can't copyright titles. So my White Identity Politics book is going to eclipse her White Identity Politics book. I'm also going to write a book called The Great Replacement, because why not? Right? No one can stop me. And it's a great title and a great meme. Jardina looks at polls that have been done of the American electorate over a 7-year period. The numbers are not extremely high, between around 800 to 1,200 white people polled, but they're high enough for valid social science conclusions, so she's published it. And I think that it is very encouraging what she comes up with. We've been predicting for a long time that as white dispossession increases, that white racial identity will also increase. That when whites feel like they're running everything and they're not threatened, it's easy to think that we're not even really a particularly racialized group. We're just human beings. We're just human beings, and all the other human beings want to be just like us. That's sort of the default liberal assumption, that we don't even belong to a race or a group. We're just humanity. And everybody else wants to be just like us. It's a deeply ethnocentric supremacist attitude, but that's really the liberal attitude in this country, in America as well. You would only expect people like that to become racially aware if their sense of being secure and simply representing humanity was somehow challenged. And of course it's being challenged. It's being challenged by diversity. It's being challenged by people complaining that even white liberals are racists, right? That people who don't see race are racist. Right? There's no redemption anymore. Even if you're a white liberal who does everything possible to help out the non-whites, they'll still say you're a racist. And I encourage this attitude because it's making more whites race aware, and it is also driving people away from that liberal paradigm towards a more racialized consciousness. So Jardina looks at 5 questions, and the answers to these questions are interesting. The first question is about the importance of white racial identity to Americans today. And there were 5 or 6 possible answers to these questions. The top 2 categories are the people who think that racial identity is important, or very important, or extremely important to them. And if you add those 2 numbers up, between 28 and 42% of Americans say that their racial identity is very important or extremely important to them. Now, if you add in the people who say it's moderately important to them, you get 52 to 73% of white Americans saying that their racial identity is moderately to extremely important to them. Now, that's very interesting. If you compare it with blacks, however, it's kind of sobering. The number of blacks who say that their racial identity is very important or extremely important is 69 to 85% in the same polls, which means more than double the white rate, basically. And the number of blacks who say that their race is extremely important to them, just that alone, ranges from 45 to 61%. Racial identity is very, very important to black Americans, far more important than it is to white Americans. But the fact is that more white Americans than in decades past are now saying that their racial identity is important to them. Another question that they were asked about is their pride in their race. Do they think that white people have a lot to be proud of? And again, the numbers in the various polls range from the 30s to the 40% for the people who think that whites have a lot to be proud of, or really a lot to be proud of, like the top two categories, which is quite interesting. The number of people who respond positively to the statement that they believe that whites are being discriminated against by the system in America is quite interesting. Now, the system would be business, academia, the political establishment, and so forth. The number of people who deny that white people are being discriminated against by the American system today, which we are told by leftists is a system of white privilege, the number of people who believe, in effect, the white privilege claim is anywhere from 14 to 25%. That means that 86 to 75% of Americans believe that white privilege is not a real thing. And then, in fact, it's just the opposite. The whites are being penalized in America today. And the number of whites who believe that it is a good thing for us to collectivize and organize to protect white interests is also remarkably high. The people who say that that's not necessary range from 16 to 23%. Again, that means that 84 to 77% of white Americans believe that it is okay and maybe a good thing to one degree or another for whites to collectivize and organize to protect their interests. Well, what is it called when whites collectivize and organize to protect their interests? Well, we call that white identity politics. And white identity politics really ranges on a spectrum. There's what we call implicit white identity politics, which is what basically Republicans have been doing for a long time. They get white votes by proposing policies that just so happen to fit in with the political preferences of white people, but they always frame these policies as just good for humanity or good for America. They don't explicitly court white people, but they will put policies out there that white people respond positively to. That's implicit white identity politics. On the other extreme is explicit white identity politics, which is the kind of stuff that I'm arguing for in my manifesto and really everything else that I write. And then there's this large category in the middle. This is the growing category. This is the category of people that the Republican Party doesn't want to touch explicitly. But again, between 84 and 77% of the U.S. populace believes that it would be okay for whites to organize to protect their group interests. They're not necessarily envisioning white nationalism, a white ethnostate. They're not necessarily envisioning an end to multiculturalism. But as long as there is multiculturalism, they are damn certain that whites have to take their own side in the ethnic conflicts that exist in multicultural societies. That's a very large number of people who believe that. The Republican Party will not appeal to them. They simply will not appeal explicitly to white interests, but very large numbers of whites believe that that would be perfectly legitimate. Now, I call these people in the middle, this growing population, uppity white folks. They're not ready to be white nationalists, and yet they are ready for white identity politics within the context of a multiracial, multicultural society. That's a huge number of people. And the great task that faces us is to get inside the heads of those people. And I want to just point out one thing about their mentality that's very, very unusual, and that Eat Well and Goodwin and also this Giardina book talk about. And Giardina is especially useful because she actually has numbers, and recent numbers, that show that the populace of Americans who have positive racial identity and are willing to countenance white identity politics does not significantly overlap with the Americans who have negative attitudes about other races. Let me just repeat that. There's a large population that thinks well of being white and thinks that whites should look out for their interests. And there's also a population of Americans who have very negative views of other races. And those two sets do not significantly overlap. There's only a small overlap between those groups, which is very, very peculiar. Is she saying that there are lots of people who have very negative attitudes towards other races, but don't have a positive view of their own race? Yeah, that's a possibility, right? There's just a lot of cynical, nasty people who think that everybody's bad. They don't like blacks, but they don't particularly like white people either. That is a possible category of people. There are large numbers of people who might have negative attitudes towards other races, but don't think that it would at all be permissible for whites to organize politically. They might be so politically inert that politics doesn't even enter their mind. They're just annoyed with black people playing their music loud or something like that. And that's it. That's all there is to it. So the minds that I want to get inside of are the people who are ripe for white identity politics and yet don't really have any negative attitudes towards other racial groups. And the question I basically have about these people is, are they disingenuous or are they clueless? Because if you believe that your group is a good thing and you strongly identify with it and you believe that it's under threat and you believe that it's okay to collectivize and organize to protect its interests, then exactly who are you protecting it against? If there's an us, isn't there a them? And if you're really going to engage in identity politics, you've got to identify the them. And eventually, you might start drawing conclusions about them that could be negative. At the very least, you have to draw the conclusion that they have different conflicting interests than you, or there's going to be no identity politics at all. So there's something kind of peculiar going on here. I think that white people, they just want to be nice, right? They want to think well of everybody. I think Prometheus in the legend was a white person. And if Prometheus was especially like a Nordic type, if Prometheus were chained to the Caucasus and every day a vulture came to chew his liver out, he'd tell himself, well, you know, that vulture just has different interests than me, and he's got a nest of little vultures at home he's trying to take care of, you know, and I don't really blame him for what he's doing, and I don't want to have any negative anti-vulture generalizations. He'd feel bad about himself for drawing conclusions like that. But even Prometheus, after a while, as that vulture came back again and again, would start having a dim view, right? He might start out wanting to think the best of everyone, but when you're involved in an existential conflict, eventually you start feeling enmity towards other groups. And right now, white people are willing to engage, or at least contemplate, identity politics, but they're not willing to contemplate what identity politics entails, which is actually fighting against other groups for dominance in a society. They haven't quite gotten there yet. Now, the big question that we face is it possible to have valid white identity politics that actually advances our ethnic interests without ever getting people to fundamentally own up to the fact that politics involves us and them and conflict and so forth? Can we really engage in identity politics and still be really nice? I think that's what a lot of our people would want to do. That's their default preference. And I wonder, can we get anywhere while leaving that preference intact? Or are we going to have to radicalize people? All right, are we going to have to get them more serious about what it takes to actually preserve your interests in the face of ethnic displacement and ultimate ethnic annihilation? The good news is that there are a lot of people who are willing now to consider white identity politics. The bad news is that they still want to be really, really nice and think well of themselves and think this isn't really that serious. And I guess the great question that we face is, how much do we want to burst that bubble? How can we do that? And how can we burst their bubble without just coming off as grim, depressive madmen and inescapably marginal people, evil-minded, bloody-minded fanatics? How can we burst that bubble without marginalizing ourselves? I think that's a great question that we face. So that's really what I want to work on. And I think the time has come for our movement to start doing our own empirical research. I'm a philosopher. We do everything a priori. We stand way, way back. We don't do studies. We don't do questionnaires and things like that. We don't do science. We stand back and interpret what scientists do. That's what I'm doing. And I'm trying to put it in a larger political context. But it's time for us to get serious about understanding the minds of the people that we want to save, because they are moving in our direction. And what's bringing them in our direction is not our brilliant, appealing websites and message. In fact, most of these people are totally unaware of us. If 80% of white Americans are saying it's conceivably a good thing that whites should organize to protect their interests, believe me, that 80% has not been reading Countercurrents. I mean, I see the numbers. We are read by a tiny fraction of that population. So what's bringing them in our direction? It's not the magnetic force of our movement, which is largely unknown to them. It's the push of multiculturalism and globalization itself. That is pushing people towards us. Now, there's an implication of that which is very encouraging. The establishment wants to censor us. They think that the only reason why multiculturalism isn't working is naysayers like me having a YouTube channel or a Twitter account or a website. That's not true. Most of the people who are giving up on multiculturalism and globalization have never heard of us. They've never heard of our movement. They never saw a single tweet by Jared Taylor before Twitter shut him down. What's driving these people towards us is the system itself and its policies, and the system is not letting up on those policies. It continues to double down on those policies, and that means that our consciousness is rising and will continue to rise, even if they successfully censor every one of us. That's a very encouraging thing. It doesn't all depend on us. It depends on the fact that our people are basically wired the same way we are. There's a line from the Dark Knight film where the Joker says, "We're not monsters, we're just ahead of the curve." We're not monsters for being ethnocentric. We're perfectly normal. We're just a little more sensitive than other people in our society. So ethnic displacement is bothering us first, but eventually it's going to bother everybody else because they're all fundamentally wired the same way that we are. And that means that even if we can't reach them, they're still going to draw the same conclusions when faced with the same data. And the data is increasingly inescapable. It's increasingly hard to ignore the consequences of multiculturalism and globalization. So more and more of our people are going to be pushed in our direction. But we need to understand what they're thinking. We need to understand how to bring them further along, how to deepen their awareness, and how to make it politically potent so that we can actually create the changes that we want. And that's really my next project, and I think it should be a broader project of our movement. We now have trained academics who can do the same kind of analyses as Jardina and Eatwell and Goodwin. We need organizations, we need money, we really do need a think tank to try and lay the foundations for having a more scientific understanding of what's happening in the consciousness of our own people and how then we can lead them forward basically to freedom and to salvation, because that's ultimately what we want. It's shocking. Manufacturers of silly things, people who manufacture bracelets made out of candy, people who manufacture selfie sticks, people who manufacture utterly frivolous things, have a greater understanding of the minds of the people that they're trying to reach and sell their product to than we, who represent the legitimate interests of our peoples and are trying to save them from extinction. We understand the people we're trying to save less than the people who are just selling junk to them, because we haven't done the research yet. We haven't done the work. But there are interesting and encouraging clues that are coming out of academia that I think that we can exploit. So with that, I want to again, thank you for inviting me here, for coming out, for being the country that has been most receptive outside the Anglosphere to my work, and for being the country where this book is now in your native tongue. I would love to sign copies and talk with you about it. And with that, I will thank you.